R22 tout le monde. Antenne cadiste.
Hi. So my name is Victoria. Thank you very much to Antonia and Eliana for what has already been a long-term collaboration by art world standards, right? We tend to always kind of operate on project-based timescales, and maybe that's actually one of the problems of our field. And I guess maybe coming back to your point around lack of sustainability when, you know, you're not actually being paid out of the thing that you're investing all your life into. I think apart from, let's say, the issue of not being able to maintain it on a personal level, I think another problem is that you can't actually create anything scalable. And I feel that that's probably one of the key problems in this stark asymmetry that Antonia pointed to in terms of the relationship between small-sized spaces or institutions, underfunded institutions, and large-scale institutions, that large-scale institutions have the scalability, in a sense, to at least somehow recapitalize on those who are capitalizing on them. And I will try to explain what I mean by that throughout my talk. Let me just find my notes. As Antonia and Eliana introduced me, I'm a curator. I'm also a researcher. That's a very important dimension of my work, in part because I do believe that in order to, let's say, make changes at the field of contemporary art, you kind of need to develop also alternative ways for understanding what this field is. And I also do consultancy work, which is actually a very fairly recent development, but it also shows how there is a certain desperation, I think, in this field, but also actors who want to interact with this field in terms of understanding, like, what is this field actually about. So one of the issues that I've been working on recently has been trying to understand, or actually for a very long time, but more recently on the financialization aspect, which is one of the reasons I'm super happy about the former presentation, because I think that gave a great lead into what I wanted to talk about. Although I didn't really want to go into financialization, this is something that I talk about most of the time when I do public talks, and I'm kind of sick of it. So I didn't really want to explain it because it has so many different tiers according to which we need to understand financialization. I think the previous presentation really showed very potently that financialization is not just an economic phenomenon. It's something that's tied to what has been happening in societies, at least since after Second World War, definitely with increasing technological complexity, definitely with increasing integration of, let's say, different markets, different states, so-called globalization. So I think, but there's also a sociocultural dimension to financialization, which I think goes largely unnoticed because we tend to associate it with an economic phenomenon. And in part, we're associated with an economic phenomenon because the people who've been studying it and who actually work in the field are economists, although now they're increasingly becoming kind of data scientists and coders, and which also shows a certain intersection between finance and technological development, something that I'll speak about again. So to return to the kind of proposal that I wanted to put forward, maybe as a way to lobby for something that future climates should probably do, is to think about how we could put more emphasis within the sphere of contemporary art on deploying financial strategy as a route to diversifying and charting the futures of transnational art ecologies. What do I mean by that? So I think typically, and I think this was very clear from the previous discussion, typically the way we think about finance in our sphere is funding for the content that we need to produce as producers, right? It's the kind of horrible part of our jobs, or not our jobs, or the jobs that other people do for us, that we kind of need to do in order to survive, in order to go forward, in order to do the thing that we love, the labor of love, the kind of the art, et cetera, et cetera. What I'm suggesting is that financial strategy is much more than just support for your project. I think it's also a really important part of the political dimension of any project. And I think it's also a very important part in setting a certain pathway towards a future horizon. And this is not something that can be done, I think, on an individual level. I think this is a very much a collective project, which is why coalition building or, you know, platform building, whatever you call it, right, is it seems to be an incredibly important dimension of this project. So the other aspect that I want to kind of emphasize is that we can't think about the art field, the contemporary art field, simply from the perspective of, let's say, the local, the national, let's say, your kind of the practices that you're interested in, that your institution is interested in. You know, it's a highly integrated transnational network. And this kind of integration of transnational doesn't mean that the circulation always happens at transnational level. Of course, there is the local level. But I think in order to actually be deemed as a contemporary art space, as a contemporary art institution, you somehow need to have a link to this transnational. And I think once you link up to the transnational, you realize you're a part of an ecology. Ecology that has rules, that has protocols, that operates according to certain agendas. And for me, what's really interesting is to understand what are these rules, why they have come about, and what can we do in order to, if not, let's say, transform them, but to at least kind of modify them in order for certain dysfunctionalities and deficiencies of the system to kind of to be altered, to be bettered. So I think the shift that I have described also describes a certain maturation or maturity of thought, of understanding one's position in the contemporary art sphere. And I think this kind of trajectory maybe charts a lot of pathways, maybe also in this room, where you kind of move from a position of critique, understanding like you kind of you can deploy your critical capacity to understand what's wrong with the system, but you can't quite understand because you're still responding to single phenomena. You're still responding to single problems, whether it's a cut in a certain, I don't know, public subsidy, whether it's the unfairness of the fact that it's the billionaire class that's capitalizing most on the precarious work of artists, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, this is still a critical position. I think from that, it's necessary to move to kind of a critical systemic analysis where you understand contemporary art as a system, but also a system that's integrated within other systems, within the larger economic system. And from there, I think it's possible to develop a strategic point of view where then you can locate yourself back at a local level as an agent, an actor within this kind of huge, but at the same time, I think, comprehensible larger system, and move from what Keller Easterling has called knowing what to knowing how. I mean, this is the kind of the standard move from critical modality of thought to strategic modality of thought. So one of my starting point when I when I was still in the critique phase was to think how there is this awkward dissonance between the content that's produced in the art field, which, let's say, in the best case scenario, right, it's critical, it's challenging, it's engaging, it's transdisciplinary. It tends to focus a lot on structural injustices and systemic dysfunctionalities, whether that's of capitalism in general, or whether it's about kind of historical injustices, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it's enough to look at what kind of shows you know, you see at major institutions, but also smaller institutions, right? You know, it's always there is always some sort of political, ethical agenda. If we consider it to be a good show, there will be some kind of political, ethical agenda. I mean, of course, there's like the you also have the highly formal conceptions of what is contemporary art, and I'm not denying that that doesn't exist. But I think in general, good contemporary art within this field is something that has this like ethical, political drive to it. So that's at the level of content, and this is where we think critique. This is the rightful place of critique, right? It's like what is produced, the artistic kind of statement through artworks, the curatorial statement through the exhibition, the institutional statement through the mission statement. But then you have the operational reality, which is the kind of the stuff that actually supports the production of what I call the front-end content. And, you know, the operational reality we have started from very kind of, good description of it. You know, it's basically unfair, oppressive payment structures is one of the most defining structures of realities of this field. And then there are certain others which I will explain, which I think are really critical to understand if we want to start rewiring the larger ecology of this field. So the first is what's called the herding syndrome. I mean, this is this comes from economic theory. Actually, John Maynard Keynes was one of the first people to kind of, I think, coin that term when he was describing stock market behavior. And what he was basically describing is behavior in a self-reflexive system. So it's a system where all the actors know that they're being observed, and the only way for creating value is herding around clusters of intense activity. What does that mean? That means that you're basically constantly amplifying and reflecting the activity of weighty actors. So this is the most kind of risk-free way of operating within a system which is unregulated, essentially. So in the sphere of art, we can see that when we look, let's say, at major museums and what kind of art they show, right? There's a certain, if not homogeneity, but there's definitely network clusters that we can see, right? Whether these network clusters are based on kind of artistic movements, on artistic networks, on gallery networks, etc. I mean, this is very evident. And I think this is becoming more and more prominent as the kind of the liquidity problem in the art field is getting worse and worse, particularly for even larger institutions, right? They kind of need to rely on the most risk-free investment into their program in order to make the ends meet. So the kind of the herding syndrome, it also falls into what's known as the right tail market also syndrome, which is where privilege flows to the already privileged. All right. And so let's say there's always the kind of the market actors are always chasing the top artist, the top collector, the top institution. And this is, you know, as you can see, this is very much tied to reducing risks of operational behavior, right? So, you know, the only way you can really guarantee that you're investing into the right kind of artistic practice, into the right kind of collaboration, is when you know that others are doing it as well. And you would want, and you understand that not just any other, but others who are already considered to be significant and weighty actors in this field. And this is a huge problem, not just in terms of ever changing anything about unfair and oppressive payment structures, right? I'm not even talking about that. But it's a huge problem for the future of art itself. Because what that leads to, effectively, is to complete kind of destruction of any form of experimentation. Because it means that actually experimenting and trying to pave new ways for understanding how, you know, art can function, how art can be produced, disseminated, they're closed down because these are just too risky for investment. So that's the kind of final point here, which is the lack of avenues for non-conventional art practices. And I think the non-conventional art practices are really key in order for the field to develop, in order for it to kind of generate, to keep on generating innovation in a non-trivial way, in a way that actually expands possibilities for art, but also expands possibilities for what art can be within society. So, this was the point of critique, right? So the next stop, as I said, is kind of critical systemic analysis. It's kind of, you know, wiping away the tears and actually thinking, well, why? How did this happen, or what does this actually mean? And I think, firstly, I think what we need to recognize is that there is a reason why critique is located within the content of art, within the content of exhibitions, within the content of front-end art field activity. And that is a historical reason. I mean, this is just, it's the history of the evolution of modern art, modern into, let's say, contemporary via conceptual. I mean, I have written about this. I'm not going to go into details. A lot of people have written about this. But, you know, with the 60s, it becomes this sort of the art object becomes a really potent form for critiquing established order of society. So this is the paradigm that we inherit, right? So we still kind of rely on the art object or the art practice to be the site of critical engagement. At the same time, what this actually meant is that this idea of ontological liberalism, which means that there are no internal criteria for what is art, right? Art is sort of valorized at the point of entry into the institutional complex. This leads to sort of a situation where the infrastructural dimension becomes super important. Because yes, you as an artist, you know, can have your Duchampian moment and say, yes, this is art. But in fact, as Lise said, you know, in her talk, how this is valued, whether this is valued as art, will only be decided at the point of entry into the art ecology. So here I think it becomes important to realize that the infrastructural reality of the art field is incredibly important in determining actually what the art field is. And this is, you know, once again, why it's so crucial to continue having not just these conversations, but trying to work towards possible strategic solutions of how we can work with the infrastructural dimension in order to, well, in order to make the field a little bit more live up to its kind of critical promise. And as we have also kind of heard in the beginning, and also there were some reference to that in the previous presentation, you know, the art moment, the kind of the critical art moment became kind of a very important point of neoliberal redemption since 2008. So, you know, what do I mean by neoliberal redemption? You know, so let's say within the context of at least Western European states, maybe also North America, where there's, you know, where there are certain austerity measures that are brought into place, means that there's detraction of public funding from some very critical social spheres, you know, of running a society. But then you have an art institution that performs criticality, that performs being political, that, you know, looks at all of these issues and dissects them and says this is so terrible and so wrong, et cetera, et cetera. So there is a certain kind of uncanny, and I don't think it's intentional in the sense of, like, actually there was somebody with an evil conspiratorial plan who said this is a great idea, right? Let's have the art moment, the kind of redemptive moment for all the evils of neoliberalism. But it so happened that this intersection occurred, right? And I think the next question is, like, what do we do in order to move away from that intersection? So, well, first of all, I think it's important to understand what financialization is and what its implications are. Because, as has been pointed out in the previous presentation, financialization is very much about the possibility of transforming everything, absolutely everything, into an asset that can be integrated into the circulatory realms of financial circulation, right? This has huge implications not just for, you know, for banks, for institutions, for governments, for people, but it also has huge implications for the very dynamics of capitalism since industrial modernity. And one of the huge kind of impacts is it's the fact that capital value, so the reason why something would be invested into as an asset becomes determined through investor confidence. So this is once again why there was so much emphasis on confidence in the previous conversation. What does that mean? It means that the pivotal figure is no longer the owner of the asset, but it is the investor who grants the kind of, who deems a certain venture worthy of investment and worthy of becoming, actually having a chance for life. And so this transformation that we see with the privatization, it's very much about, that's the political problem with privatization ultimately, is that if formerly, you know, in theory, you had the state in certain parts of the world, once again, in very limited parts of the world, there was the state that was accountable to its populace that made decisions about what is worthy of investment. Now it is a private individual, a private company that starts that is not accountable democratically, etc., that decides on what is worthy of investment. And so this is also what happens to the museum through privatization or through increased private funding, etc. This doesn't necessarily mean something bad or good. It's just that's a complete turnaround in governance that we need to understand. And it has a huge impact for the value of critique and for what critique is. So then critique is no longer just this kind of critical gesture that, you know, can be understood as an important political statement, but it's also an asset because it builds confidence in the institution, in the eyes of the public, in the eyes of the investors. These investors may be different investors, you know, from kind of private family money to corporate social responsibility, etc. So, you know, those of you familiar with the history of institutional critique, that's basically what happened. I mean, institutional critique became just quite a highly prized asset precisely because it heightened the confidence of all of these diverse parties in the institution, because the institution could actually use it now. Then there's this third thing that Michel Fayer talks about in relation to financialization, which is, this is all great, but how is actually value determined, right? If it's no longer based on production, right, and production outputs and, you know, all of these kind of competitive standards that we associate with industrial production, how is value decided upon? And so he talks about criteria for accreditation, which, in the financial realm, you have various companies like Standard & Poor's, which were very important in the financial world because they're the ones actually creating the accreditation for different financial institutions, for different assets, etc. And so they are the ones kind of signaling what is the value of something that internally, inherently, doesn't really have any value. And in the sphere of contemporary art, or I think in the sphere of the cultural field in general, criteria of accreditation are created through institutional valorization. So actually by entering the institution, does something become, an artwork becomes valuable. And the parties who ultimately are part of institutions, they're the key agent for deciding on institutional valorization. And I think another part, sorry, this is tiny font. But another thing that we need to keep in mind is that although, the financial condition is something that we're all subjected to in one way or another, as is the neoliberal condition, which I think is, it's also a dynamic one. And so we can't really understand the current split that exists, let's say, between the claims at content level and the infrastructural realities as some sort of like transcendental historical fact that will continue on forever. And I think we already see certain movements, and like this is a map that's sort of trying to map these movements, where, on the one hand, you can have increasing, basically, if you have a contradiction between the critical claims at the level of art discourse, and then you have the shady infrastructural realities that people increasingly become aware of. And this is, I think, it was a point around, artists not even kind of realizing you should be asking for a fee, right? And all of a sudden, artists realize they should be asking for a fee and start doing it on a much more systematic level. But nothing changes. I mean, what you have is you have an increasingly cynical ecology, right? But this presumes advocacy, right? You need, in order to kind of continue on sort of drilling on that it is a problem, that there's a contradiction between critique and infrastructure reality, you need advocacy. So, but then a cynical ecology, if that does happen, come around, I think it does, it is happening in certain parts of the art world, it's really bad for confidence. It's actually really bad for confidence in the field. So what is likely to happen, I think is already happening in part, and there's certain case studies that I'm not going to go into because this is on Facebook Live right now, but it's value depreciation at systemic level, which means that the power of institutions for valorization within this financial environment will decrease. What can happen from then, and this is also, I think, in part happening now, is you have this thing there, which is blue chip reconsolidation, where it's just, the top galleries, the top museums that kind of reconsolidate. And reconsolidate, I think, very much in relationship to the luxury market and to the financial institutions that are driving the luxury market. But with all of these, I think, you know, then I had the other branch, which is, okay, let's say things stay the same. So homeostasis, because there's denial, because it's okay, everything is fine. We'll just carry on critiquing, it's all cool. But I still think there would be, at a certain level, a disinvestment of critical agents. So actually the driving forces, like people who are really committed to the critical agenda that they put forward, which once again leads to certain kind of deviation to contemporary art as standard luxury market. But in all of those cases, I feel what's inevitable is a reform, a restructuring of the sphere. And so I think this is where the strategy point comes in. If we know that reform and restructuring are inevitable, like what can we as individual cultural actors do, you know, for our personal benefit potentially, right? Or for whatever agenda, whatever project we kind of believe in. So I think the strategic approach is to recognize attention or tensions between possible horizons of emergence, so what could happen, right? So you kind of dynamically map what could happen to the system, and existing conditions, and identify leverages and capabilities that will allow you to somehow strategically sort of mold your path. I mean, this is super abstract and super general, in part because strategy can only be very specific in relation to a very concrete party. But I think what I'm trying to chart is a way of thinking rather than giving kind of concrete recommendations. And so speaking of emerging horizons, so I wanted to give kind of an example of what I mean by an emerging horizon. As probably many of you know, some of the new kind of entities that have started populating the art fields are digital platforms. So Artsy is one probably of the most prominent digital platforms that, apart from sort of writing about art, you know, kind of functioning sort of as a news channel, newslettery thing, they also see themselves as an educational platform. I mean, the most important thing that they do is they amplify the activity of local galleries, auction houses, and art fairs at a global, kind of digitally accessible level. So basically, their kind of unique selling point to the art field, when the primary market firstly kind of freaked out when they thought that artists would always, you know, would disinvest from the primary market and go to Artsy and sell there. But Artsy were smart enough to be like, no, 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 don't worry. We're just here to amplify your activity, primary market dealers, etc., secondary market auction houses, etc., because you only have access to the audiences that you have access to, right, physically. We have access to the whole internet. And so they kind of, you know, they did this very kind of Silicon Valley pitch, and it has actually worked quite well. And I think, but I think what is interesting about Artsy is not even, you know, how they use this kind of the herding syndrome, what I've described before, in order to basically pitch a business plan, which makes so much sense. But actually, what at the back of it is that, they're also aggregating huge amounts of data, right? And they're aggregating data about transactions, about, you know, what people like, who's buying what, etc. The kind of data that, you know, is sort of is in, could in theory be gold if they would, someday start wanting to kind of really financialize the art market on the terms that you kind of financialized your house, right, the art index. So actually like proper financialization, because one of the reasons why proper data-driven financialization has not happened in the art field is because there's lack of data transparency at the level of price setting, so valuation, you know, that we don't know how prices are set, like there's no public forum where that's known. But also transaction, right? Transactions at primary market level are not recorded. So this is, you know, and I don't know what kind of contracts they sign. I mean, this is part of my PhD research, but I don't actually know. I don't think anyone is going to tell me what kind of contracts they sign with galleries and with, it's something I should look into. But I mean, I should pretend to be an artist trying to sell. But it's evident that, you know, there is something going on here, and I think, and computation, financialization are a really big part of it. So this is kind of one emerging horizon that I just wanted to flag up as something like to be aware of when we think like, where is our art ecology going to? And in order to be able to devise better strategies for our own kind of financial models. And this is just to support the fact that tech is a huge market for the future of contemporary art from the perspective of institutions, financial institutions with money. So if you look at the sort of jump from 2010 to 2015, or even from 2013 to 2015, in yearly venture capitalist investment into art market startups, like, that's massive, right? So in a sense, this is taken from a Deloitte Art and Finance Report 2016. In a sense, I think there is an understanding that it will be tech startups, right, along the lines of Artsy, that would kind of break the contemporary art market for the kind of for financial institutions, for like, you know, hardcore data-driven financialization. At the same time, what we have happening, we have emergence of a new type of actor, which is a boutique loan issuer that specializes exclusively in artworks as collateral, right? And this is something unusual. I mean, typically you would have the kind of wealth management branches of financial institutions that could, in a sense, use your art collection as part of your, you know, larger wealth as a collateral and a loan. But rarely would you have just artworks securing loans. And I think the emergence of something like Athena Art Finance in the last 2 years is also indicative of kind of how this blue chipization, what I have called that, of the art field is something that is happening. It's here. And I mean, I guess to confirm that even more, this is a newsletter from October 4th, 2017, so very recently, and Athena Art Finance will now become the lead partner for the Armory Show. Yeah, so that's big. I mean, I don't need to explain that. So I think what are some of the key traits that I feel we need to recognize about contemporary art, and how do they contribute to what I call lack of ecological diversity? So the first part is what I describe, which is, I think, you know, key actors associate like you, me, before, in my kind of before, yeah, times, associate the heart of their work with the content level rather than the operational level, right? So you associate, I mean, that's very evident when you say, you know, I run a space because I run a space. It's not because I earn money from it. I earn money elsewhere, right? So that's a very good description of it. But this in turn means that we delegate the structuring principles to sources of liquidity inflow, to where the money comes from, right? And their mediators, which are quite homogenous, right? So I think that's one of the reasons why we can't get out of this public-private money debate, or why it's so difficult to come up with alternative models, because ultimately the people who are dictating the protocols, they're not interested in different models. So in a sense, this leads to this kind of top-end heavy market, of what I call the blue chipization. But it also leads to a really poorly thought through relationship with capitalization, which means that, you know, as was described in the previous presentation, so you have a new kind of Starkitect build art museum. Rarely does that art museum think that it should be getting a cut from all the real estate developers who are developing in that area, right? So that's a very global problem, but I think it exists at absolutely every single level of the field. But another point that I'd like to imprint, that capitalization is not necessarily, it's not always bad. I mean, I think we all capitalize on each other all the time, and this is part of contemporary reality. What is bad is that it's not really spoken about, and we don't really think about the terms on which capitalization should occur. And I think one of the kind of areas for reform or for really thinking strategically is like, you know, how, who is sort of capitalizing on my activity? Whose activity am I capitalizing on? And how do I want to structure these relationships? I mean, this sounds horrible, I know, but I feel it's sort of part of like, in order to kind of get to a more empowered place, this is a very necessary step. So tying all of this back to my point around lack of ecological diversity in the art field, it seems that, you know, we are aware that socioeconomically, like racially, geopolitically, this is not a very diverse sphere. This is also something that is constantly spoken about, as I said, at the kind of front end, at the discursive semantic level of art production. But I think more insidiously, what this also means is that there's a dearth, or there are the very few key actors in the field who are promoting a more diverse way of for producing, engaging, and disseminating art. Right. So everything is going towards homogenization and multiplization. And I guess going back to the efflux model, I think it's a very interesting case in point, because one of the reasons they're so successful as they are is because they're effectively a monopoly on communicational kind of, on both kind of communicational, distribution of communicational capital within the contemporary art sphere globally, right? And that's smart, but it is a monopoly. So the question becomes like, how do we, you know, how do we diversify? I think diversification needs to happen through increasing types of economic mediation. It means that, okay, yes, there is the public funding pot, and then yes, there is the kind of primary market possibility, but there need to be other ways, there need to be other kind of forms of mediating economic exchange, because only through that can ecological diversity occur. This also means, but this is not going to happen in one day, because actually the actors who are either kind of have a monopoly over a certain over exchange or over a certain domain, they're not interested in their monopoly being disturbed. And that's an absolutely rational behavior, right? So like, we can't really blame them for that. But for that reason, I think it's really important to populate our field with what I call kind of proto-regulatory entities, like WAGE, for example, solidarity platforms, and advocacy groups, right? So these are not really the kind of entities that are typically associated with a contemporary art ecology. But I think they're absolutely critical, absolutely crucial, if we are thinking of reforming this ecology towards a much more fair infrastructural reality. So this is... But the question then, it becomes on what terms, right? And very quickly, because I realize this is too much and everybody's really tired, I wanted to go to, let's say, so, you know, it becomes obvious we need to kind of import and modify certain entities and models that have not been historically part of this field. And then the key question becomes on what terms, because, you know, we have, for example, some of you might know it, the artist pension trust model. In theory, it sounded kind of good, mutually kind of assured pension trust, which means that you put in, I think, 20 artworks over a period of 20 years, and then you get returns on that once the fund starts selling off the works, and that effectively becomes your pension. And so what this is trying to kind of ameliorate is this huge discrepancy that I described before that exists in a right-tail market where privilege just flows to the privileged, right? So here there's an attempt, supposedly, to redistribute that privilege. But then when you look at the actual percentages of the numbers, this becomes a bit suspicious. So 40% goes of the sold off work goes to the authors. Okay, that's maybe more or less the standard gallery model, right? Then 32 goes to other scheme-holding artists who may not have been so successful. But a gobsmacking 28% goes to the Artist Pension Trust, which itself, right? And so, and you know, yeah, so that means actually, that means 336,000, so for example, out of 1.2 million, which is what they sold off in 2016, 336K went to APT, and then the artists who were supposed to be, you know, kind of the trickle-down object, subject, they received $192. So, because there were 2,000. But, you know, it kind of, it sort of shows the, you know, the kind of the plan sounded good in theory, but actually in practice, this was pretty terrible. But at the same time, what's interesting, right, so this is a very shady model. And we realize the shading is of it comes in part, we don't really understand how it's governed. Its governance is completely lax, you know, there's no transparency around that. And so this is not great. But then if you go and Google Artist Pension Trust, this is what I love, right? Actually, the top results that you get is about how dodgy it is, right? And so what I think...
Now.
But there, yeah, maybe I wasn't. I did Google it then, but I don't remember what the search results were. But for me, this is indicative of something that's quite unique about this field, which is the ability to generate actually kind of negative reputational value quite easily. And I think that's something worth thinking about, actually, as a very empowering condition. And, you know, I think this is something that Lise refers to as well in her wage talk. When she talks about coercing institutions, she doesn't actually mean, you know, holding a gun up to the head. She's working with a lot of really great, powerful American institutions and on very amicable terms. But I think it's the possibility of this that becomes the leverage that you deploy as a platform that's trying to push a very controversial issue within a field. And so... there is another model, I think, for doing pension trusts, which I think is quite innovative and quite brave in the sphere of finance. And this is not from the art field. This is from the real world of finance. It's actually from Estonia, which is a very unique place, because on the one hand, you have sort of hardcore neoliberalization there. On the other hand, you have a lot of... it's a very small place. I think it's part of the reason why these things can happen, where basically a bunch of people who used to work in the financial world, who were lawyers, also an artist, got together and thought our kind of private pension system really, really sucks. There are loads of hidden costs that go into managing this trust. The governance structures are really obscure, so very similar to the APT thing. You know, we get completely ripped off. We need to change that. So instead of going for a startup model, they went for a mutual model, meaning that basically people can join the pension trust by contributing, I think, I don't know what the, I forgot, sorry guys, it's either 100, but it's something, it's a very small amount. And so you contribute that amount and basically you get a vote and you become a co-owner of the pension fund. So it's collectivization. I mean, it's a mutual fund, basically. But what they decided to do is they wanted to transform this fund. So it's regulated. It has like all the licenses that you need to have in order to operate as a pension fund within that jurisdiction. But what they decided they wanted to do was to kind of stage an experiment as to whether it was possible for the stakeholders, the people who will be receiving the money, to also become decision makers in the process of how the pension fund is managed. And so this is what they're experimenting with. And they're also experimenting with aligning with certain political views, which is seen as a very controversial. So, for example, they kind of supported... I think they support like a gay parade publicly in on their Facebook wall, in part to see whether there were like any hardcore kind of Estonian fascists and nationalists who were part of their constituency, and it was really interesting to see what came out of that. And I think this is a very radical move on the part of a financial actor that doesn't do politics because all they do is they're professional finance. And so I find them quite interesting for that particular reason. They also lobby for legislative change. So for example, the hidden costs that I was speaking about. I think they were already successful with one reform proposal at parliament level. So what I'm saying is that, you know, there is a way that not all financial models are made equal. And I think it really matters what type of model we import into this ecology. I think what goes without saying is that proto-financial institutions, proto-financial actors will become a norm in this field no matter whether we want it or not. So the question, I think, is what kind of actors these will be? You know, what sort of governance ideologies and governance structures will be at the back of them? And I think that, you know, the contemporary art ecology is on the one hand a highly protective environment, as we saw from that Google search, right? But I think one where kind of solidarity-based advocacy platform could have high impact, given the importance of reputational power and maintenance of a politically conscious brand within this kind of financial condition that demands confidence. So yeah, so actually, happy future, everyone. Thank you.
And in this description, you talked a lot about the institution and the art world and the connection with galleries and some network of galleries. But there's just one thing I wanted to hear about is the rising, like the development of auction houses in the first and secondary market, which for me have a huge impact on what we understand in the art world. I had a very small experience working for one, and I just couldn't believe how important that is going to be in the art world and the impact on the market, on the curatorial practices. Because what I realize is they're developing like collections. Maybe not collections, that's maybe the wrong term, but they're buying so much and investing on those artworks. And they're also doing primary market shows, which I found it incredibly dangerous, and also seeing like a lot of emerging artist exhibitions, where I could see people who graduated 5 years ago already being auctioned, and the lack of control through that by galleries representing those artists and the damages that can do to the
artwork. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a specialist particularly on the kind of evolution of policy within auction houses, but I think auction houses have always been really important for the art field, right? I mean, they're always seen as this kind of borderline actor, which is sort of part of the ecology, but also somehow external to it. Whereas it's really obvious if we talk about capitalization that they're totally inside. I mean, you know, even like on an anecdotal level, if you look at sort of Sotheby's or Christie's sales and you look, let's say, Tate Modern MoMA exhibitions, and you see there's always some like half a year gap or maybe even less, 3 month gap of certain artists being auctioned off. And their, you know, whatever, mid-career or like just life retrospectives, right? So that's very evident that this is like very much part of standard modus operandi. In terms of like more expansive, let's say, activity across, as you said, primary markets, more as, let's say, institutional actors, I think maybe it's more recent. I associate it even more with such actors like Philips, for example, right? Yeah, I mean, yes, I mean, that's. I think that's part of the whole, when I say there will be more actors who are financial actors, right, within the field, that's kind of what, they're one of the genuses which will start populating the field more and more, because it's a much better financial model when you're so diversified, right? When actually you have so much capital, you have so much scale, and you're so diversified. And so, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's one of, if not emerging horizons, but like horizons that has already arrived, for sure.
And let's eat now.